Our third case this morning is number 21-1787, Kluge
v. DHS. Mr. Rennie? Yes, sir. May it please the court. This is a case where the big federal bureaucracy with its finger pointing and dissembling is really grinding the little guy. And the little guy in this case is a class of reservists who volunteered for duty during the war and served as their orders, as their written orders will attest, directly in contingency operations. USERRA clearly says you can sue OPM directly, and the board, quote,
shall adjudicate. So the legislative history of this statute shows that the purpose is to make sure that those serving in the military don't suffer financially as a result of the service. That's but in fact, you're asking that your client be paid more than he would have earned if he'd remained at DHS during the period of his military service.
Perhaps.
How's that consistent with the purpose of the statute?
Yes, sir. I understand the butterball position of Mr. Kluge just simply states that if the government used the daily rate, if they're going to use the daily rate, then they have to do an apples-to-apples comparison, and then butterball would apply. It basically means that you don't charge against for weekends and holidays. That's all Mr. Kluge
is proposing. You're not answering my question. How can it be that the statute is designed to create a situation where someone who serves in the military gets paid more than if he continued with his civilian service?
Your Honor, it's a fair point, and perhaps if the government would not have used the daily rate, we wouldn't have the confusion. But the fact, our position is, it looks like if they're using the daily rate, they should incorporate butterball. And that's basically the position. It's understandable. There may be other ways to do it, and we encourage the government to use other means to comply. Even when they use the pay period by pay period analysis, they still devolve down to a daily rate comparison. That's all our position is on that. On the other points, on the USERRA, the direct naming of OPM as a party, USERRA clearly states that you can sue OPM directly and that the MSPB shall adjudicate those cases. When finding noncompliance, they shall enter corrective and compensatory orders. That didn't happen in this case.
Can I just ask, and you'll know these statutes better than I. So I guess there is the statute that lists OPM as a potential defendant in some USERRA cases. USERRA certainly has some USERRA obligations about promulgating certain categorizations or something of classifications of positions and whatnot. Why, though, isn't the question whether OPM is a proper defendant in this case where the underlying violation is a non-payment action taken by a different agency, namely the specific employer?
Because, Your Honor, the non-payment was caused by OPM's misleading definition that's still on the website as of yesterday, that this court has overturned twice, in O'Farrell and in Adams. It's a blanket exclusion for all 12301D activations, and that is not only wrong, but this court has overturned it twice. That is what the agencies are relying on. As you can see in the record, Appendix 571 to 576, the government admitted in the other case in federal district court that the federal agencies all rely on OPM for their guidance on how to apply the differential statute. Not only that, they said not only do they rely on it, but they said it had legal consequences that clearly flowed from that guidelines that came out in 2009. And what most importantly, it affected the circumstances under which federal employees could qualify for differential pay. It was decisive of why this class was denied the differential pay.
Okay, but the legislative history of the statute shows that the reason the OPM is named was twofold. One, it has its own employees. And two, it has certain USERRA obligations, for example, under 4315E, to help place employees who can't return to their original jobs. There's no indication in there that the promulgation of guidance by OPM would make them a proper party defendant in the case.
I understand that position, Your Honor, but I argue that they also had regulatory responsibility to ensure coordination and compliance with the statute, and they failed in that obligation. I think, and more importantly, USERRA itself determines what the standard is for liability, and the standard is, USERRA sets the standard, it simply requires corrective orders and compensation shall be paid, quote, for any loss of benefits suffered by reason of such lack of compliance. When all the agencies are relying on OPM's guidance and definition, and that OPM guidance and definition is wrong and fails to incorporate this court's precedent, then they are the reason of such lack of compliance and the cause of the denial of benefit in this case, de facto. In addition, Your Honor, I just want to point out that under the broad and generous pleading standards of the NSPB, Mr. Kluge actually named as a class all federal agencies in this case in his complaint. It was very direct, and that was also never addressed by the court, by the NSPB, in their decision. I think when you look at the record in the case, it's obvious that this court's holding is settled law on whether 12301D activations do qualify for differential pay. And O'Farrell and both Adams said they can. It's settled law, but what we need in this case is settled compliance by the federal agencies. Even DHS, I mean, even if you're just setting aside the issue of whether OPM's liable, but DHS itself has failed to recognize this and implement this in their policies. When this case came up, their first reaction was to say, we don't know it. The second reaction was to say, we don't know if we owe it or not because we're still doing a legal review on it to see if people in that particular circumstance are owed differential pay. And then finally, when they were, I think, in an attempt to moot the case, they said, okay, we owe it, but just for him, we're not paying anybody else who's in the exact same situation, even if we do owe it. There's a reluctance to accept that 12301D is a valid basis for this benefit. And it's obviously in terms of, in the case where someone is either activated in support of or directly into a contingency operation. Now, the distinction there, quite frankly, in practice, is not all that significant in reality, because all the orders usually say in support of, and that includes anybody who's on the front line who might have been killed in action or whatnot, or somebody in Nevada who's operating a drone and shoots lethal ammunition and kills an enemy on the battlefield. Everyone is activated in support of a contingency operation. And the key here is all the class members in this case will have orders that have directly activated them under 12301D in support of or directly into and will name a contingency operation like Mr. Kluge. And more importantly, even probably more telling, is they will have a fund site for a contingency operation that can only be expended for personnel who are directly in a contingency operation and operating in support of that. They all qualify under this court's precedent and whatnot, and there needs to be a corrective and coordinating order to capture that, and so they don't have to file individual claims in this case.
Counsel, I've got a question about the gray brief on page 9.
Which brief?
The gray.
Okay.
Gray? Yeah. So on page 9, my question is about the sentence here, the in addition sentence. You talk about the court having inherent authority to direct its ruling under USERRA or the Tucker Act, for that matter, to cover IC personnel. I'm just wondering what your case law support or what your source is for that particular statement.
Well, USERRA case law, the USERRA statute itself clearly covers IC personnel. It's the coverage for USERRA, if I have it here, includes other federal agencies, and it basically defines the universe of federal agencies that are outside of Title V. I also want to point out that's obviously relevant only in the parallel case in federal claims court. That case involves Mr. Kluge as a plaintiff. It also involves Mr. Schwieger, who was an IC employee. Now, IC employees obviously don't have MSPB jurisdiction, and so that's why that case is more of a universal coverage for all class members in this case than this one. But the USERRA statute does directly address coverage for IC personnel. And for that matter, so does the differential pay, because differential pay incorporates USERRA's jurisdiction and covers them all. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Okay. Let me jump to the class action denial. The board cited five grounds for denial, all of which were not supported by substantial evidence. The first was privacy, and it's not clear why privacy would automatically require, you know, a certification would require violating the Privacy Act. There's no explanation and no facts in the record to back that up. In fact, it misstated Mr. Kluge's claim, which is we could have the government handle the database comparisons, and that would obviate the privacy concerns. That's unsupported by evidence. The second was the monumentally wasteful notion that this case would require identifying all federal employee reservists and doing an individual analysis of each employment situation. Mr. Kluge did not propose that. There's no facts or any evidence to back that up. He proposed doing a database analysis that would determine the class and determine back pay within seconds, automated. It's not necessary. Again, that was unsupported by evidence.
If there were a class certified, would you contend that OPM would be the appropriate defendant, or would other agencies need to be joined as defendants?
We contend that OPM would be enough, because you could order them to pay, but all agencies should and could be defendants as well, because I believe almost every agency is involved in following OPM guidelines and denying this class the benefit.
Into your rebuttal time, do you want to save the rest of it?
Let me just address the commonality, sir, and then I'll save the last minute and a half for rebuttal. On commonality, the AJ accused Mr. Kluge of not alleging that all agencies have acted in the same manner and based on the same actions. On page 30 of the opening brief, there's about 20 or 30 pages in which he made this direct allegation that OPM was the source. And similarly, the denial cited the 2013 furlough cases, which clearly are not similar to this case. It involved hundreds of different agencies that had to submit thousands of records to create separate agency administrative records by which adjudication would happen. That's not the case in this situation. There's one OPM misleading guideline that needs to be overturned, and that's the one common contention. And I'll stop there and save the rest of it for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Long?
Thank you, Honor. May I please report? The key point here is that when presented with the differential pay claim, DHS authorized the claim. It found Mr. Kluge eligible, and it proceeded to calculate his differential pay due. And so that puts the lie, I think, to a lot of the arguments here. When we look at the statute, 55, section 5538, it's clear that DHS is the agency responsible for paying.
Wait. Did you say puts the lie? Is that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You shouldn't use language like that in oral argument.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Let me reformulate that. My point was simply that the agency that was required to pay in a differential pay due was DHS. And so the idea that OPM would be the proper respondent simply doesn't make sense. It didn't have the authority to decide whether anything was due, and OPM wasn't obligated to pay any differential pay claim from its funds. When DHS was finally made the proper respondent, as I've said, it found him out, found Mr. Pooja eligible, and it calculated the differential pay due. Similarly, with respect, and so it was not an abuse of discretion to make DHS the respondent. Similarly, with respect to the class, Adams, I think, makes clear that it's not an automated legal analysis as to whether or not a given service member is entitled to differential pay claim. Putting aside the fact that Mr. Kluge's claim was found eligible in this instance by DHS, every differential pay claim is going to require a look at the orders. We see this happened in Adams, and an inquiry into what precisely the activation was for, and then a determination of differential pay is due. And so that makes class certification unwieldy, and under the board's regulation, class needs to be the fairest and most efficient way to proceed. The board did not abuse its discretion in concluding that that was not the case here. Finally, with respect to the calculation of differential pay, I'll just address Mr. Kluge's position on this daily comparison. Looking at 5 U.S.C. 538A, the pay period is the relevant period for calculation. And so we see that both the OPM guidance, which the board did not adopt, and the board's calculations are geared toward ensuring that there's an accurate computation of the amount of military pay earned allocated to a given pay period, and that is properly matched against what the civilian pay would have been during that pay period. And so, while I think it's fair to say that the board used the number of days in situations where a civilian pay period straddled military pay periods, in other words, where a civilian pay period was in both February and March, for example, the board used an approach that decided how many days fell within February and how many days fell within March. But that process of computation was focused on, again, the pay period and how much military pay was earned during a pay period so it could compare it against the civilian pay period. And that approach is completely consistent with the statute and therefore lawful and appropriate.
Mr. Long, can I ask you this question? Is there a forum in which there can or is being litigated the question whether the feature of the OPM guidance that's being objected to here is lawful?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say as a predicate, I think you'd have to have a situation where an employing agency pointed to that guidance as the basis for its decision, at which point the court would be in a position to make a decision. Now, there could be a couple of approaches. We saw in Butterball, as it happens, the Department of Justice relied on OPM guidance, and this court asked whether that guidance was lawful. And that was in connection with the USERRA claim, obviously. So that could be one avenue. And then this court would be in a position to say, well, DOJ, or in this case DHS, appropriately relied on lawful guidance, or the guidance was unlawful, and therefore the decision cannot stand. Mr. Kluge has also, as it's shown in the record, has also raised APA claims in district court. Those claims now, I think in a proper situation, he probably could mount an APA claim.
Do I remember correctly that in a filing in the district court in Mr. Kluge's case in the district court, you agreed that the guidance was final agency action?
I am not recalling that statement, but we did say, and this is the statement that Mr. Kluge has sought and secured judicial admissions or judicial notice on, is that OPM's policy guidance was directed to and relied on by federal agencies make payments to qualifying employees. So that statement does appear. Now, as I've said before, it obviously wasn't relied on here because Mr. Kluge said it would have knocked out his claim, and DHS here accepted the claim. And so Butterbaugh, I think, is probably the clearest way that we can see how board itself would have jurisdiction to consider the agency's reliance on OPM guidance, and then that would be subject to this court to review. But the district court might be another venue, and I believe Mr. Kluge's district court case has now been transferred to the Court of Federal Claims, styled as a Back Pay Act case, I believe, also still alleging a violation of Section 5538. And so I don't believe that the government has not answered the complaint there, but that may be another avenue to challenge this guidance.
But why shouldn't the calculation here be a lot simpler than OPM has made it? And that is, you just take the amount that the employee earned during the period of military service, and then compare that to the same amount for the pay period that it would have earned in civilian service, and to the extent that you need to allocate amounts from within a pay period because there's overlap, you just do that based on the number of work days. Why get into this complexity that the OPM guideline imposes?
A couple of points, Your Honor. First is that, as I said, the statute takes a pay period approach. It could be the case.
Well, this is what I'm suggesting is taking a pay period approach instead of figuring out the amount that's due for each individual day, which seems not to be consistent with the statute.
Well, I don't know how you would do that in situations where a pay period crosses months, because military pay is, in this case, was different in different months for Mr. Kluge. And so you have to find a way to take that military rate of pay for February 2011.
You just take what he earned in the military for the period that he was in the military, and then you figure out how much he would have gotten for that same pay period in his DHS employment. It's not complicated.
Because I understand, Your Honor, because the military pay period is 30 days long. So he's not paid on a biweekly pay period basis that matches up to the civilian pay periods. He's paid on a monthly basis for the entire month of February, a gross amount. And then you need to divide that into days, which your purchase has been used is to divide into 30 days, which is every military pay month is 30 days. And then you have to convert that over to that biweekly civilian pay period. That's the reason, Your Honor.
Anything further?
If there's nothing further, we respectfully ask the court to affirm the board's decision.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Long. Mr. Rennie?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, on your point, the section in USERRA is 4325 regarding enforcement on the other agencies. The complication here is this is USERRA. Differential pay incorporates USERRA jurisdiction, so the other case is Tucker Act, actually. That's why it applies to in that case. On the issue of whether or not the government argued that it was final agency action, the 2009 OPM guidance, they clearly did argue that, and I think it was understated by counsel what the effect of that was. In the final admission, and it's found on the last six pages of the joint appendix, they admitted that guidance affected the circumstances under which a federal employee could qualify for differential pay. I mean, you can't get any more decisive than that in final. This case is also similar to Pusilowski, which was referenced in the judge's handbook, in which this court actually found that overturned the board and said you should have issued a corrective order against not just the employing agency in this case, but several other agencies, including DFAS, TSA. He was a DOJ employee. So there is precedent in this case to do this and issue the order against OPM. I think the court, with all respect, ought to hold OPM responsible for this as well. And if not, he's sued the other agencies as well. They can pay for it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.